On today's show, the financial trend that some experts are calling a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. But is it right for you? Plus, do you know what the letters ADU stand for? Well, it's part of a new take on something pretty old in the housing market that some have called granny flats, some call them in-law units, and sometimes backyard cottages. We're going to talk about that. And perfect for all this real estate talk, we have Chad Carson, a.k.a. Coach Carson, with us as our guest co-host. That and so much more coming up on this edition of Money with Friends. Welcome to Money with Friends. I'm Bobby Rebel, host of the Financial Grown-Up Podcast, coming to you from my very grown-up kitchen in New York City.
And I'm Chad Carson from the Real Estate and Financial Independence Podcast, and I'm coming to you from my forested office in South Carolina.
Looking good, Chad. All right, we take two headlines from the financial press. We're going to use them as a foundation to share money insights and specific ways that we can all get better with our money. We're going to wrap it all up with one big idea to set all of us up for success. And most of all, we do it with our friends. Not only do we have our regular money friend, guest co-host like Coach Carson that bring fresh perspectives to the podcast, this show is taped live in front of a Facebook audience. Their comments are part of the show as well. For more information on how to be part of the audience, you can see our schedule at our website, moneywithfriendspodcast.com. This episode of Money with Friends is sponsored by Tiller, your financial life in a spreadsheet automatically updated each day. Go to stackingbenjamins.com/Tiller for a free trial and, of course, to support the show. Hey, Chad.
Good morning, Bobby. How are you?
Good. I am excited for your big trip that is happening. You are bolting the country for the summer.
I'm taking off. Yeah. So I have two young kids and my wife. We're sort of travelers. We have the travel bug every once in a while. And so the kids are out of school and we are headed to Ecuador, to Cuenca, Ecuador, up in the Andes Mountains for 5 weeks to have a little retreat down to South America.
And you're able to do this in part because you've built this like real estate empire and content creation empire, I should say, because you don't just invest in real estate. You also talk about it and share your knowledge with other people. And you can do that basically from anywhere, which is incredible. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So my main thing is real estate and I have rental properties. And so it wasn't always like this, but over time it's built up to the point where the regular income from rental properties pretty much pays the bills. It has to have a little bit of a cushion. And also have really good people who help me manage that. So that combination of regular income from rentals and good people on the ground allows me to have some flexibility and I can travel. And, you know, I was telling you earlier that, you know, sometimes, you know, real estate seems like such a local thing, but you can pay bills from anywhere in the world. If you have a smartphone, if you have a computer, somebody sends me a plumbing bill, I can pay that $70, $120 bill like anywhere and press the button on the computer. So that's pretty much how I roll with my business.
And as one of our regular money hosts for this season, you're going to be with us three more times, 4 weeks apart for each one. And I think we may even be planning to attempt to do one from Ecuador. So you can even do on-camera podcasting.
Exactly.
Anywhere in the world. So definitely everyone tune in. For about 4 weeks from now, check our calendar at moneywithfriendspodcast.com. We'll have that information when we know it.
And that one will be all in Spanish too, right, Bobby?
No, I took Spanish in school and then not. So, all right. On that note, let's toss it to one of our friends to get us into the headlines.
This is Caden from Lubbock, Texas. You supply the coffee. We'll supply the headlines. You're listening to Money with Friends.
All right, I'm going to do this headline because it is near and dear to my heart, Chad. It's by Beth Pinsker from my old employer, Reuters. And Beth was a huge mentor to me. She used to always correct, let's just be honest, the word edit sometimes, but actually it was correct in the case of Beth. She was constantly improving my writing. And so I love everything that Beth writes. I think she's always, you know, on the money. And actually the column is called Your Money. And it starts like this: buying or refinancing, the mortgage rate frenzy is back. Mortgage rates are nearing historic lows again in the United States, making it an ideal time to buy a home or refinance. Quote from Keith Gumbinger, vice president of HSH.com, a mortgage information website. Quote, it's amazing how many times a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity comes around. This is the opposite of the steadily upward movement of rates that experts forecast for 2019. Average rates are around 3.82% nationally for 30-year fixed mortgages after peaking near 5% in November. The dynamic could shift again. Actually, it's referencing the Fed meeting that just happened. Sorry, this article is a day old. The Fed did not raise rates, so we'll just leave it there. Although mortgage rates are tied to the U.S. benchmark 10-year Treasury note, they are sensitive to global economic trends. When to refinance? Let's just read a little more of this. The people who need to pay the most attention are homeowners who are eligible for refinancing. Some 6.8 million borrowers currently could benefit from a refinance, according to analysis by Black Knight, a mortgage data analytics company. Borrowers on average could save $268 a month. A significant share are new homeowners who bought in the last 12 months when rates were 4.5% or higher. So, Chad, okay, you invest so much in real estate. Do you think that the economics support refinancing? And do you refinance a lot of your properties? Or are you flipping them, or at least when you were flipping them more, is that something that you didn't really pay that much attention to?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. And when you're either a homeowner who's going to own a property for a long time, or you're like me, you're a buy and hold rental property investor, in either case, like if you have a long-term horizon, refinancing is a really big deal because we all have heard of compounding interest and maybe you put some money in a savings account. Well, you know, interest rates are sort of the opposite of that. You know, they're just, you make a mortgage payment to the bank and a very small interest rate change. And I say small, like 1% is not small, but you know, some people a year ago might've had a 4.5% interest rate and now, or 4.8, and now they can get a 3.8. You know, if you're going to own the property for 20 years and pay interest, that 1% over 20 years is an enormous number. So this is a big deal for people who are in as homeowners who have, you know, bigger loan balances. And it's a big deal for investors as well, and a landlord who wants to eventually get that loan paid off. If you get a lower interest rate, it'll help you build wealth and pay that loan off a lot faster.
Are there different metrics that you should look at if you're an investor versus if you're a homeowner?
It's pretty similar. The only difference is with a rental property, I mean, obviously you're getting rental income coming in. So it's more like a business of, hey, I've got to generate a certain amount of revenue and I've got to have expenses, and interest is just one of your big expenses. As a homeowner, though, I tend to look at things a little bit differently as a homeowner. You know, there's a big argument in the financial world, like, is your home an investment or is it not an investment? Well, whichever side you land on, we know it's one of your biggest, the biggest purchase you make very often in your life. And so if you're spending $400,000, $1 million in some of the bigger cities, you know, that is an enormous purchase. And so I think you should look at it as an investment. And to the extent that you can save money on that on expenses, your biggest expense is interest. It's absolutely, you know, a bottom line improver. It's going to make your wealth. It's going to grow wealth faster. It's going to increase your income, perhaps, if you can lower your monthly payment. That's going to put more money in your budget that you could save, that you could put somewhere else. So it is a big deal.
I want to jump forward in the article to a part that talks about another trend, which I had not really been aware of. And the article goes on to say, the number of millennial buyers doing cash-out refinances also spiked. In a cash-out refinancing, homeowners remove a portion of equity from their home while adjusting their loan rate. The key to deciding whether a cash-out refinance is worthwhile is to consider the cost of the debt versus where the money will go. Paying off high-interest debt or student loans, buying investment properties, or paying college tuition for a child might make sense, but using the funds for a vacation or a big television would not. What do you think about that idea of, like, taking equity out of your home to pay up, say, a student loan debt?
Yeah, my first impulse when somebody says I'm going to cash out my loan, I get a little like, oh man, a little red flag, because it's so easy to let that money slip through your fingers and buy the next vacation or buy a house. You know, that money, that cash gets in your bank account when you refinance and it gets spent. With that being said, if you're smart with it, like the article was talking about, if you borrow money at 3.8% and you pay off a 10% credit card debt, I mean, that is a big deal, as long as you don't go back into the credit card debt. Like if you can get that habit down where you're not, whatever happened to get that credit card debt in the first place, maybe it was an emergency, maybe you just had to spend it. Or if you had student debt, one-time student debt, and you're paying that off. I mean, it is, again, it's called an arbitrage in the financial world. You're just lowering your cost of money, which is a smart thing to do. And investors and, you know, Wall Street investors do that all the time. I mean, conscious of interest rates. And so if you're running your own little business, which is your home or your real estate business, you really should think about the same thing.
What about the idea that then you have less equity in your home? Is that something that would worry you at all also? Because you're taking money out, people may not realize when they go to sell it, what if the market changes, right?
That's the big risk, right? So when you have a credit card debt, I mean, that's unsecured. Technically, they might be able to sue you or come after you for that money if just things went really bad. But if you always have to think about the worst case scenario with real estate, because real estate is not very liquid, meaning if you're going to put it out on the market, it's not going to sell tomorrow. You're going to have to stage it and get it ready. And it's not like a stock where you can just press a button and sell it and get the money. And so the more you borrow against your home, the more difficult it is in a challenging situation. Like 2008 and 9, where properties dropped by 30, 40% in some cases. If you go from a 70% loan to like an 80 or 90% loan, you know, you're putting yourself a little bit more at risk. And so that's another, I'm glad you brought that up, because you really got to be careful and think about not only the profitability of an investment, but also the risk. You know, that's what Warren Buffett and people like that think about. They're always there. I think the rule, what's the rule number one? Have you ever heard his rule number one of investing? Don't lose money. Don't lose money. Yeah. His rule number one isn't like get the lowest interest rate possible. Don't lose money. And so I kind of, when somebody who's worth what, $80 billion or whatever it is, has one rule, I'm like, okay, I think we should pay attention to that.
All right, Coach, we've got some questions from the audience here on Facebook Live. Let's take Ron's question. Oops, I picked up the wrong one. We'll get to you, Jim. Let's take Ron's question. Do you leverage with bank mortgages or private lenders? BRRRR method, 20% plus down.
Oh yeah, so he's speaking code words. So anybody who's in the investing world,
I know from listening to your podcast, these are things that you do cover on your podcast.
Right.
But explain it to our listeners.
Yeah, so we in the real estate nerd world, which I am wholeheartedly a part of, the BRRRR method is essentially, let me explain it really simply, is you buy a fixer upper property or your home, and you buy it below value. And then maybe either you force the appreciation, like you make it go up in value by fixing it up or something, or over time it goes up in value and you refinance it with a lower interest rate mortgage kind of for the long term. That's what the buy, remodel, refinance, rent, repeat. That's what the BRRRR stands for. Buy, remodel, rent, refinance, repeat. So it's a strategy that real estate investors use to buy. Instead of flipping the property, they keep it, they buy it, they fix it up, and then they rent it out. And it's relevant to today in the interest rate conversation, because the lower the interest rates are, when you refinance, that's more money in your pocket. It's a better cash flow for you as an investor. But he asked me, what do I do? I typically use what are called private lenders. That's just been my strategy, where somebody has, you know, another investor who doesn't want to do all the rental stuff, has $200,000, they'll loan the money to me and become my bank, essentially. And I pay them 6% interest, and they get interest from me every month, and I manage the property, and they don't have to deal with all that. So that's my little strategy. But many people use bank mortgages and just go to the refinance with a bank and do that instead.
All right, let's take a question from Kevin in our Facebook audience. What do lower interest rates mean for REITs, real estate investment trusts?
Yeah, I'm not a big REIT investor. So real estate investment trusts are essentially like mutual funds in the real estate world. There are ways that instead of you having to go buy a rental property yourself and own your little rental property, you could just invest in this company that owns many, many rental properties, and they're publicly traded. So they're more liquid than regular old, you know, a house or something. But I think in general, I'm assuming this is, you know, that like me, when interest rates go down, that helps my cash flow as a rental investor. So I would assume some of that's going to be helpful in the short term, that some of these REITs will be able to refinance some of their acquisitions from last year. But I'm not sure big picture what that does for the whole REIT scene.
All right, let's move on to our takeaways, Chad, before we move on. What is your takeaway from this story?
I think people need to be opportunistic with real estate. You know, real estate is not like, you know, the stock market sometimes moves like that. You know, things will drop, things will go up. Real estate's a little bit more of like a slow moving animal. You know, it just kind of plods along. And, you know, when we have a crash, it's just like, you know, 5-6 month crash. And also their opportunities are kind of like that. So interest rates are an opportunity. If you're a homeowner, if you're an investor, you know, pay attention to these. If you refinanced a loan at 4.5% last year, and it gets to about a 1% below what your original loan was, that might be a time to talk to your mortgage broker and see what you can do.
And my takeaway is really just echoing what Chad said, that paying attention pays off. Run the numbers, look at the math, and take action. Don't just wait indefinitely. If the math works for you, make it work for you. And that only happens if you actually do what is best for you and actually go do the refinancing if the numbers work.
Yes, numbers. Run the numbers for sure.
Let's go to the next headline.
So my headline is, there's a bill to reduce restrictions on accessory dwelling units in California, and it's gaining steam. So as housing costs soar, a California state legislator is working to make it easier for homeowners to build accessory dwelling units. They're also known as ADUs. And they're working to make it easier to build those on properties in order to provide residents with more affordable housing options. Accessory dwelling units, ADUs, have gone by a wide variety of names, things like granny flats, in-law units, backyard cottages among them. And they can serve a wide variety of uses, such as a guest house for extended family, a home office, a short-term vacation rental, or an apartment for a non-family member. So, yeah, I want to go into a little bit more about what those are, but at first, just, have you ever lived in an ADU? Have you ever heard of that, Bobby? Because I think it's kind of interesting.
I mean, I think the closest thing is someone in my life, I'm not going to call them out, is waiting to build a house on property, and they're going to build like a little cottage, basically a pool house to live on while they build the bigger property, because it would just take too long. They don't want to not have a home. So they're building something that will eventually be like a pool house while they build the dream home. And so that is kind of a little, you know, and it's just basically a garage and a room, like a bedroom. Maybe there'll be a little kitchenette. So they're like mini housing units. And I think that from this article, a lot of cities are looking at them because it's a way to basically, in some ways, cram in more housing, but also it creates more affordable housing because not everyone needs the full house. Not everyone needs a single family house.
Right.
Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, it is. It's essentially, just think of it as a small house, small apartment, but the key here is it's on the existing property of a normal house. So it could be something in the backyard. Yeah. So like somebody has a big, you know, 3-bedroom, 2-bath house, and they have this backyard space that people used to just, you would just leave the whole, have a lawn or grass out there. People, the trend is, especially in higher cost of living areas, California being the example in this article, it's becoming a solution to one of the biggest challenges of today, is that people can't find an affordable rental. If you're going to be a teacher in San Francisco, like where can you like live off a teacher's salary and actually find a place to rent? You know, it's really difficult. And so it's a tough problem, but one of the solutions that I think is the most practical and interesting that's kind of on the trend now is that local governments and state governments, in some cases, are legislating to make it required that local governments allow a homeowner to build this little granny flat, this small house in the backyard. And what does that do? In some cases, you know, think about somebody who's trying to age in place. You know, they are living there, their taxes have gone up, the place is really expensive, they don't want to move though. They might be able to build this ADU in the backyard, rent that out to a college student or to a young family or something. And then they can use that income to actually stay in place instead of having to sell their property, move somewhere else.
So why is this something that was controversial? It doesn't sound like there's any real downside to this. And yet this is something that has not really been allowed.
Yeah. So have you ever heard this term, not in my backyard?
NIMBY? Yeah.
NIMBY, yes. In the real estate world, like NIMBYs are, it's such a cliche because everybody says that. It's like, oh, that's a great idea. Affordable housing, such a good idea. We ought to do that. And then the local government says, hey, we're going to allow some apartments to be built right next to you because they are more affordable. And, you know, big, huge 3,000 square foot houses are not affordable. Therefore, we want to build apartments that actually normal people can live in. Mm-hmm. And everybody says, no. Like, do that on another part of town. Don't do it in my backyard. And so I think that's the essence of the challenge, is that local government is very responsive to the squeaky wheels, the loud voices, and just to be straight, like the suburban single family house zoning lobby has been much louder than the practical, hey, we ought to build some reasonable density into some of our neighborhoods so that people can actually afford it.
Right. And this is really this story is focusing on California. So it's interesting to watch if it will spread to other regions of the country, other states. there's also been a lot of news in California, for example, most recently Google, about putting money into affordable housing and mm-hmm. controversy around that, because the reality is they're hiring. The numbers are astonishing. The number of people that are being hired for positions in certain regions, in this example of California, relative to the number of new housing units, there's a big gap there. I mean, this is, you know, a big crisis waiting to happen, I think.
It's huge. Yeah. I mean, and I'm not in California, obviously, but I pay attention to it a lot. And the gap is in like the millions of homes, I believe. You know, it's just like, it's like a staggering number. Like, and so if you ever wonder, like, if you're out looking for a rental or looking to buy a house, like, why is it so difficult to find? It kind of gets down to supply and demand. You know, there's a huge demand. Populations are increasing. People are moving. Google's hiring people and paying them hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so if you're somebody, again, I'm thinking about like you're just regular bread and butter kind of person working and making a job, making $80,000 a year salary as a teacher, like, where, how can you compete? And so prices are outrunning the normal salaried person, and people, what do? Like, typically they drive an hour and a half or two out, you know, they go out into the suburbs, which is another issue too, right? If people are driving, climate change and driving and gasoline costs. And so it's just a really difficult problem. And so that, but I think, part, you know, Google spending money as a start, you know, you're having some of the people who are causing the problems, who are causing success, they're a successful company. That's great, right? But it also brings some downsides, some shadow issues, which are housing costs get run away from a lot of people. And so Google, I think from the article you referenced, is trying to spend some money on subsidizing some of the housing, making loans to affordable housing units, which could be a one good solution. But legislation, I found just on my local level and setting other legislation, is one of the biggest obstacles, because it's so expensive and it's so difficult to build housing in California, for example. And so the more expensive it is, if it costs $100,000 even to break ground on a house, then it's going to be really difficult for that person to go build a small 800 square foot unit and still make it make sense as an investment. And so I think that's this article and the trying to change legislation on the state level is trying to at least address that as in some way to make it more affordable for your regular person who lives in a house to build a backyard unit and have some form of extra housing in an area.
Yeah, it could be a very long haul. We do have a question from our Facebook Live audience from Bill. What do you think of local government requirements to live on the property in order to house hack with a short-term rental a la Airbnb?
Yeah, good question, Bill. So just to set that question up a little bit, you know, Airbnb is, you know, is sort of like a hotel, you know, where you're renting some of your spare bedrooms or you're renting the granny flat to people who come in for a night or two. And the trend has been with a lot of local governments is to legislate that and say it's either illegal to do that, you can't do it at all, or if you can do it, you have to live in the house and then before you can rent out the backyard. And, you know, I'm still on the fence about that. Like, I think it makes sense in a lot of cases that somebody who lives in the house is going to be a more conscientious landlord, you know, because they live there, they're renting their backyard out, they're not going to just let anybody in the house. On the other hand, I'm a landlord, and so you can know my bias up front. I think the good landlords kind of get outweighed by some of the bad apples, and there are a lot of landlords who are a solution to affordable housing. They're providing housing. So if you legislate away some of the Airbnb is a little bit more of a niche. It's a short-term rental, but you know, I think the trend of legislating and restricting so much on landlords is kind of it's a knee-jerk reaction, and it is actually making some of the affordable housing issues worse.
And what do you think about people that compare these to the tiny home trend? Do you think that this idea, beyond the economics, do you think as a culture we're much more open to smaller living spaces? And talking, you mentioned the whole idea of, you know, the impact on the environment.
Yeah, I think the younger generation, we could call, you know, lump all the millennials together. They definitely have some different desires in terms of housing. There's a really interesting book I read called Big Shifts Ahead. By John Burns. And it was talked about generation by generation, what our housing choices are. And millennials, by and large, have chosen to live in urban areas, I mean, by a large margin. And they also got hit really, really hard by the Great Recession, 2008, 9, and 10. And so many of them chose to live in urban areas. And now as they're buying their own homes and moving, they still want to have their own homes like some of the people in the last generation did. But they are, by and large, going to more dense areas where they can walk, where they can have local kind of street life going on. And so I think this generation, this trend of granny flats and more density and not just the kind of old suburban sprawl. Everybody lives an hour and a half from the city center and drives on an interstate. I think that's not going to be the normal trend anymore. I think what you're seeing more of is a lot of mini urban centers around the big metro areas, and they're like clusters, you know. So you might live 2 minutes from a coffee shop or 2 minutes from a little small village urban center, and then you might still commute to the big city a couple of days a week. But it's more flexible. They're living in smaller spaces. They're recognizing that you don't always have to have a car, for example. A lot of people are, you know, using Uber, so it's a slow trend. But I mean, I think the millennials are definitely changing the landscape of housing for sure.
All right. Anything you want to add from this piece before we do takeaways? We didn't read that much of it, but we said a lot of what was in the piece. So I think that was good. But go on. I'll toss it to you, Chad.
Yeah, I think the takeaway is just pay attention to that. If you're a homeowner, have you ever considered getting some extra income from your home? This is a possibility. You know, some people feel stuck. They have all this equity in their home, and yet they can't generate any wealth from it, any income. And this is one interesting, practical way that you as a homeowner might be able to long run make your home a more profitable place to live, especially in high cost of living areas.
Yeah. And the truth is, they could also, people don't think about this, but they could also move into the backyard cottage themselves. Yes. And really amplify their ability to earn money, because they may not want as much space. They may have kids that have grown up. They don't need to have whatever large house that they have. They can move into the in-law cottage or granny flat, whatever you want to call it. And that could be, instead of, you know, the trend, which I'm fascinated by, this tiny home trend that I'm just obsessed with. I think it's the coolest thing. We
Me
can't
too.
Do it. My family of five. It's not happening in my household. But I do applaud people that do. I think it's really interesting. So my takeaway is, could backyard cottages be the new tiny homes? I don't know.
I think so. It's possible.
It is possible. Before we get to the big idea, and I do invite our Facebook Live audience, if you guys have suggestions for your own big ideas that you want to share with us as well, let us know about that. But before we get to that, I want to talk about my obsession with getting organized. You have a lot of systems in place, by the way, Chad, to be going to Ecuador for like the summer, basically, and you're still running your business from abroad. You got to have systems, right?
Exactly. Checklists is what I do. So yes,
and
systems, checklists.
Exactly.
For sure.
You can run all the finances from your business from abroad. So here at Money with Friends, that was a slip. I know someone was waiting for me to do that. Money with Friends. It's brought to you by Tiller, because you can manage your money 10 times faster in a spreadsheet with Tiller, which is, as I said, all about being organized. They connect with your banks to Google Sheets and Excel with your daily spending, transactions, and balances. Unlike financial apps that force you to compromise, spreadsheets are fully customizable for your needs. Tiller makes them even better with an automatic daily feed of your spending balances and transactions. Tiller eliminates data entry, multiple account logins, and CSV files. Simply connect your banks once you see the transactions automatically updated each day. Basically, once it's set up, you don't have to do anything. So go to stackingbenjamins.com/Tiller for more info and a free trial. And note that it is the Stacking Benjamins website. We are still part of the Stacking Benjamins family. We are always part of, I shouldn't say still, we are part of, very proudly, part of the Stacking Benjamins family of podcasts. So the Tiller link is stackingbenjamins.com/Tiller. And by the way, separately, our website for this podcast, if you want to see the stories, get the links for the stories that we talked about today, or learn more about our Money Friend regular guest co-host like Coach Carson, that website is friendswithmoneypodcast.com. And we encourage you to check that out. And of course, follow us on our new socials, Money with Friends Pod. Money Friends Pod. I messed it up, Chad. Money Friends Pod. I had to make it that, because if we did Money with Friends, Twitter cuts you off with a certain number of characters. So it didn't.
So the old character limit. Yes.
Yes. We had to get creative. All right. Now we're going to the big idea. Who's going to go first here, Chad?
I want to hear your idea first. I think I like some of the comments you're adding on and giving people suggestions about moving from one, you know, the big house to the small house. So what do you think? What are some takeaways?
I think I'm reflecting my grass is always greener from my little apartment here in New York City, but we're making it work. We actually love living in New York City, and I love my home. So, but it is a little bit bigger than the tiny homes that we see on those shows that I'm watching.
Yes.
Here's my big idea. We talk a lot, Chad, Coach. We talk a lot about not timing the markets, like the stock market. I know basically you set yourself up for disappointment in many cases. homes are the rare thing where it is an investment. This is true, as we've talked about, and perhaps the biggest financial investment that we will make in our entire lifetime, at least when we're homeowners living in the home very often. But the truth is, we can't ignore external factors like interest rates and changes in regulation. This is a case where it may be okay to time the market for an investment like this within a range. And if it fits your financial goals and you have the financial means to make an investment, if you are already ready in your life to own and invest in a home, at a time like this when mortgage rates are at historic lows, timing it is something to think about. It's also worth considering opportunities that can come up where regulations are shifting. So that is also a case where timing could be a factor. Not the only factor, but it does matter. So consider investing in real estate using different metrics than investing in stocks. The current trends, be it the interest rate environment or the regulation environment, should be one of many, but still one of the factors in your decision when it comes to real estate. Did I do okay, Chad?
You did awesome, man. That's, I don't know how I'm going to follow that up.
You get the final word, coach.
All right, final word. So I guess my feedback would be it's about housing and about using housing as a wealth builder. You know, wherever you fall on the view of what housing is all about, you know, with interest rates, you have to look at the long-term trends. And the long-term investors and wealth builders that I admire and study, they look at not the like short-term fluctuations of a housing market or the short-term fluctuations of the stock market. They look at what are the long-term trends. And over the long run, these interest rates are still at historic lows. And what does that tend to do? That tends to make asset values go up over time, particularly real estate, because it's very debt-driven. And so if you're thinking about buying real estate, whether it's a home that you're going to own long run or whether it's going to be a real estate investment like what I do, when the interest rates are low, that's actually one of the best times to buy over the long run. And I know it's a very competitive market right now, so it's more difficult to buy good deals. But if you look at it with a long-term trend, if you can buy a property that's in a good location, if you can figure out a way to have some income coming in from it, maybe from an ADU or renting out your basement, we call that house hacking in the real estate nerd world, if you want to join us there. House hacking is one of my favorite things to do because you live in a property that also generates income. That's the way you can sustain yourself to get to the benefit of that long-term wealth building of real estate. So that's my takeaway, is that, you know, don't jump into housing like just because it seems great and because Chad said so. Like, run your numbers, like Bobby said, be smart about it. But if you're thinking about it, this is not a bad time to do it with interest rates so low. You ought to start looking at it.
Excellent big idea. Coach, before we let you go, before we wrap this up, tell us more about what you're up to besides cruising off to Ecuador. You got a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, so I'm taking my podcasting mic with me in my bag to Ecuador. So I podcast every week at the Real Estate and Financial Independence Podcast. You can find that on any of your podcast players. Just, you can either search for that name or just search for Coach Carson, and that'll show up. And if you're interested in what I do over at coachcarson.com, I have a blog where I have a lot of just practical articles, like how do you study the market? How do you run the numbers? I try to break it down, and that's where that kind of the old school coach comes in. You know, I'm like the guy who draws on a blackboard and shows you like 1 + 1 = 2 of the real estate world. And that's what I have fun doing. So I would love to connect with people that way.
Well, I love listening to all of your advice. So you do it so well. You teach us the basics and then you build up from there, which is just the way
thank you.
It should be done. So thank you so much for joining me for your very first of 4.
Yay, my pleasure.
Co-host appearances on Money with Friends. And everyone, until next time, go be grownups. Bye.
This show is created and hosted by Josal Sihai and Bobby Rebel and is a joint venture of BRK Media LLC and Stacking Benjamins LLC, copyright 2019. Our engineer is Caden Thompson. And for a list of our friends who appear on the podcast, head to our website, moneywithfriendspodcast.com. You can also check out our schedule for upcoming recording sessions so you can join us and be part of the show. As with anything, remember, you shouldn't take advice from any of us or any other video or podcast without first talking to your financial advisor, and that the people in this episode are here for your and their entertainment purposes only. I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and we'll see you back here next time with a real episode of Money with Friends.